Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Suze Hinton. She's a web and open source hardware developer. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm really excited to be here talking with you.
Yeah, I reached out to you because I was perusing my Medium, the medium.com over at Free Code Camp, and I saw a great new post that you put up that says, "Lessons from my first year of live coding on Twitch." And that's a pretty epic title for a couple of reasons. First, because it's lessons, I like that. It's live coding, I also like that. It's on Twitch and not YouTube or Google Hangouts. And it's my first year. Like, you could have been like, lessons for my first week. But you did something that is hard and scary, and you did it for a year, and I am totally blown away by that. So I had to talk to you.
I really appreciate that. I'm super pumped to just like look back on my year. And I think that's why I wrote it in the first place, because I think I've really grown since. So I'm glad that you sort of saw the appeal.
Did you intend to do something for a year, or are you going to live code on Twitch for life, or was this a start and a beginning and an end kind of a thing?
I don't know about for life, but I definitely just started with just doing it once. I was like, I wonder how this would go. And then I realized, oh, this is actually kind of like good in different ways than I thought it was going to be. For example, it's quite motivating and to be able to do your work when you're accountable to other people watching. So that's in the end why I stuck with it. But it definitely started as an experiment.
Mm-hmm. Did you think that, how did you come upon Twitch? Why not just Google Hangouts or like Twitch? I think of Twitch as where people go and play games.
Yeah, definitely. I think that I knew about Twitch back when it was called Justin.tv. And back then it wasn't actually necessarily for like gaming platforms. But now it's very much heavily focused around that. And I think that was kind of where they pivoted a little bit, when they became Twitch. And so I just thought that that was kind of where you live streamed your stuff. But I also noticed that there were other programmers, who were streaming on it. So I thought, okay, well, I'm not the only one that will be on there, so I should probably give this a go and try and find a community here.
Mm-hmm. Were there any particular programmers or programs or games that like stuck out at you when you were kind of perusing the people who are live coding on Twitch?
Yeah, for sure. I think the first one that I saw was Handmade Hero, and a lot of people will be familiar with that programmer. I don't know whether you've watched any of those episodes before.
Mm-hmm. I did.
Yeah, so like he kind of starts from scratch, and he makes a game, including I think the game engine, from starting with just C, not using any frameworks or libraries, and then his goal was to complete an entire game and then explain absolutely everything he was doing along the way, which seemed like a really lofty goal to me, and like super meticulous too, because you have to just keep that going and keep talking as you're actually programming. And I think that's what first fascinated me about it.
The thing that blew me away about Handmade Hero is the idea that something is being begun without an actual like thought about the end. Like, he was like, I'm going to start this. I'm going to do it for a couple of years. We'll release everything to the public domain. And, you know, if you want, he'll go and sell you the game and zip it all up. And, you know, for $15, you can kind of buy it all. But to start a project like that without knowing if you could even succeed, or what if you hit a bump for 2 weeks, that blows me away.
Yeah, I definitely have always wanted that confidence to start on something that big, and probably be okay with it if it fails too, because there's always that chance, right? So I'm sure he had the confidence in his skills to see it through. But mm-hmm. I think when you have such a huge challenge like that, it can possibly fail. And having the guts to start on it anyway definitely is quite inspiring to me.
Yeah. And he's doing it basically like an hour at a time, and he's on several hundred episodes now, 400 episodes, I think.
Yeah, and he's got like a ton of followers as well. So it's really, really cool because you can go back and just watch them if you've missed some or if you kind of like didn't start watching them when he started. So I think that's really cool too.
So did you decide to put that level of effort in it? Were you going to do like an hour a day or an hour a week? What's your schedule like?
Yeah, so I do it a lot less frequently. And part of that is like I just travel a lot for my job. And also I thought, well, so I have this friend who... This is totally related, I promise. I have this friend who needed to start flossing his teeth. And instead of saying, all right, I'm going to floss all my teeth every single day from now on when I've never been in that habit, instead he's like, all right, I'm going to floss one tooth every single day without fail. And then he kind of gradually built it up to be every single tooth in his mouth. And then that became a habit for him. And that to him was basically saying, let's like lower that barrier to entry. And so I had the same attitude. I thought it's really, really hard to find the same time on the same schedule every single week. It's much harder than people think it is. Even if you've got, you know, a weekend, even if you've got free weeknights that you're always home. And so, you know, that to me was an achievable goal. And I thought maybe I'll stream for 4 hours that Sunday, or maybe I'll only stream for 1 hour that Sunday. But if I start at the exact same time, then I have no excuses. I can't keep putting it off till later in the day and then not do it. So to me, it was just something that would be achievable. Mm-hmm. And in the end, that's been the most sustainable thing for me. I don't think I've ever increased it to be more, even though I've definitely considered it several times.
Mm-hmm. You said that you travel a lot. Do you like live stream from like the hotel?
So that would be really cool. I think that I really like the, even though my setup isn't super, super high quality, I do like having, you know, just my desk at home. It's kind of where I feel the most productive. Mm. And also I have a reliable internet connection. So I've thought about doing hotel streams, but sometimes when you're traveling, it's just another layer on top of like the stress that you have as well. And so it kind of becomes my space to just say, well, I might be a regular streamer, but I also have like a personal life too. So I think it definitely adds a human element if I have to be missing for a weekend sometimes as well.
Yeah. Do people complain? Because we do the ASP.NET community stand-up on Tuesdays at live.asp.net, and people get mad if we don't show up. Like if one of us is out of town, it's like, where are you guys? And like it's quite intense.
So some of my regular viewers, they'll definitely say they're sad. I've definitely had someone say, oh, like I normally get out of bed like early in the morning to watch Susa's stream on Sunday, but she's not streaming. Exactly. So I'm just going to get up in the afternoon instead. So like some of them will just kind of try and make me feel guilty. They'll be like, oh, well, I'm just not going to get out of bed because there's no point, which is very dramatic. But I think that that's really flattering. And it's their way of saying, hey, we miss you, which is really lovely.
Mm-hmm. I like talking to people who are trying something that's maybe outside their comfort zone. So like a lot we hear about people learning to give presentations. I've talked to people who've been programming 5 years and decided to give a technical talk. And I've talked to people who've been 20 years or more in the industry and they just gave their first technical talk. So we hear a lot about this. You see blog posts about encouraging people to give their first tech talk. But you don't really hear about that. Like we should all be live coding on Twitch or on, that seems like, I don't know, public speaking times 1,000. Like I am a somewhat professional public speaker and I am intimidated by the idea that you would go and be able to do that. Do you see that those things are related, but one is more intense than the other?
Yeah, I think that's a really great observation. So I do a fair amount of public speaking as well because I tend to work in weird spaces in open source like Node.js hardware. I tend to get invited to do a lot of talks. And so I'd been public speaking for a number of years, but when I approached starting with Twitch, I thought it was going to be really similar. I'm like, oh, I'm just giving a talk or it's just like a webinar. But it is a completely different experience. And when I first started, I felt an anxiety like that I hadn't felt for a very long time, not since I first kind of started public speaking for sure. It feels like you have a bunch of people in your room, but it feels a lot more intimate than giving a public talk on a stage, if that makes sense. Because you're inviting people into your weekend and your they can see like the live stream video of you at your desk. So it definitely feels much more intimate than a public speaking engagement.
Mm-hmm. When I give talks, I always, you know, I've blogged about this. I struggle with imposter syndrome and feeling like a phony. I would only assume that that is magnified when you are trying to produce. Like, I can produce what I call edutainment. You know, I can educate and entertain on stage. But if I actually have to write something from scratch and make it work, and that feels very, very intimate. And were you afraid that people were going to, like, I don't know, like mean anonymous people were going to be like, you suck, and here's proof. I've got it on video.
100%. Yes. I was really, really worried for a number of different reasons. So, like, I've been programming professionally for, I think, 11 or 12 years now. And so, like, I know how to work with teams and, you know, I know how to write good code, or I want to think that I do, but, you know, there's always room for improvement. And so the difference is that usually when I'm working with teams or if I'm pushing up stuff to open source, I'm testing stuff out completely with like the luxury that it feels like to me now, the luxury of privacy, where no one's watching over my shoulder and I'm just able to play with code and I'm able to write bad code and then improve it and then refactor it.
Right.
Even, you know, push it up and then force push over the top of it if you, you know, found something embarrassing. And I don't really have that when I'm live coding on Twitch. I honestly feel that there's definitely this safety net that's not there that I feel when I'm able to kind of just do that by myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's probably what scared me the most. I thought that if I started coding, that this kind of carefully crafted reputation, you know, for me professionally, where people really enjoy working with me, they think that, you know, that I'm a good programmer. I thought that people were going to find out this disgraceful secret that I actually am not very good, because they judge me kind of on the quick code that I'm writing on the live stream, right? And they're like, oh, well, this is her in a comfortable situation. But that's really not the case at all, you know? So you kind of have to embrace that you're going to be scared and embrace that maybe people will be mean. But most people in my experience have been super supportive.
Mm-hmm. I could see if I'm going to put a little bit of a fine point on this and tell me if I'm going in the wrong direction. But if I, as a middle-aged man, were to say, well, you just have to embrace that people are going to be mean sometimes. And I told that to maybe someone who is younger than you and I, and maybe just getting started. You, of course, are not just getting started, but someone who's getting started. And I said, you should go out there. Someone being mean could knock them right off of their, perch and make them, it could ruin them. You know what I mean? We hear about people getting very cruel treatment because of a GitHub pull request. I can only imagine that coding for an hour and doing a lousy job of it would definitely fuel the trolls. Don't you think that as a woman in tech, you're going to come up against those kind of mean people? And do you just push through it? Or are you not cultivating any kind of mean people like that?
Yeah, I think that that's actually a really great point to make. And it's part of why I felt fear. Like, that's another reason why I felt fear, was that for me, as a woman in tech, I feel extra pressure to be perfect at everything, you know, perfect at code, perfect at emotional labor. I also need to look the part, and just be very, very nice and, you know, not be, blunt or anything like that. And so I felt like everything was on display when I first started programming on Twitch. And I thought, someone's going to come in and either to make themselves feel better about themselves or just because they're just really, really unkind in general. I honestly was just waiting every stream for just this flurry of really awful, abusive viewers to come in and start trolling me. I honestly expected it. And I know that's really, really cynical, but just being a woman in tech and moving around that space, you know, in the industry for as long as I have, you definitely see stuff, and it is death by a thousand paper cuts. So I was preparing myself for that, which is kind of sad to think. I don't know why, and I'm still a little bit suspicious, but it actually has been very, very positive. And some of the trolls I've gotten have actually made me laugh more than anything, which was the biggest surprise.
That's good. Well, it seems also, though, that after you've been doing this for a while, for over a year, that you have a community now, and even you've even gone so far as to call them a family. I would assume that they would back you up, as any good family would, if there were trouble.
That's right. And I have seen examples of that. So, for example, I have a chat rule that says, because you can actually set up chat rules in your channel below, that says things like, hey, you know, if you like my shirt, it's cool to say like cool shirt, but maybe just don't really comment on my appearance, especially in a way that's talking about me being attractive or something like that. And some people will come in, not read the rules, and they'll be very cliched. They'll even say things like, oh, I just can't believe that there's like a lady coding, and like, that's so like awesome. And then they'll talk about my appearance. And a lot of my family, as I call them, like, if you read my article, they'll come in and say, hey, like, just call it, like, you know, women in tech are a thing. And I'm sorry if you haven't seen that before, but you know, Suze is just another developer like us. And so they're really good about doing that. And I've had some really funny trolls actually where they don't even care about that. They'll just come in, they'll see that I'm maintaining like a JavaScript library that I wrote a little while ago before ES 2015 came out. Mm-hmm. And they'll just be like, oh, you're coding in ES5. Like, why are you doing that? And like, oh, like, you can't write JavaScript. You're bad at it. And it's so bizarre to see that I'm like, yeah, if that's going to bother you on the stream, then I'm not sure this is the stream for you, because we're still having a lot of fun, even if we're not using the latest features. So I actually get more of that than trolls about my gender or anything. And again, that's blown me away how like supportive my family have been, even if that has actually happened once or twice during my streams.
You had mentioned that one of the things that was the most fun, since you do a lot of work in the, you said, in the open source hardware and kind of the Node.js hardware libraries, so talking to Arduinos and things, didn't you have a situation once where you may have had a bit of a glitch in an Arduino board while you were on a live stream?
Yeah, so I think you interviewed Daniel Schiffman a little while back, and he was saying that sometimes a lot of his videos, he has to edit out whole sections of debugging. And so, you know, I obviously don't have that luxury. And so people are kind of sitting with me, and sometimes they'll point out like typos in my code, which is extremely helpful because it's really, really hard to spot them when you're talking aloud at the same time. But then other times I'll be holding the Arduino board up to the camera so that, you know, everyone can watch the lights blinking as it uploads the program, for example. And so I try and make it so that everyone can see what I'm doing at all times, so they don't have to guess. And that saved me one day, because I was holding up the board and I was like, hey everyone, I just don't know why my software's broken. It's just saying that the Arduino board is not plugged in, right? And then someone pointed out and said, oh, your microchip is actually not stuck on the board. Like, you've popped it out of the socket. It doesn't have a chip, so it can't talk to it. So it thinks that there's nothing plugged in. And like, there is a video in my article where I just erupt into the most ridiculous peals of laughter, because it's just, you know, we were stuck on that for several minutes. And that was such a simple thing that I should look for. But, you know, my viewers are like so super smart, and they spotted it immediately, which is great.
That's awesome. Someone did the tech support. Did you try plugging it in? Like, of course I try. Oh, no, it is not.
Yeah, when they said that in chat, I was like, no. And I was like, oh, you're right.
That's epic. I'm looking at your GitHub, which is quite extensive and got a lot of great information for people who are learning about Arduino, learning about Node.js. And you have a thing called AVRGirl-Arduino. What is that project?
Yeah, so that's actually a project that I work on very heavily on my Twitch stream. It is one of the most popular libraries that I've put out there. So AVR Girl, the name itself, is like a gender bend on the software product that's already out there called AVR Dude. So
AVR thing.
Yeah, so AVR Dude, it's a backronym, so it stands for AVR Uploader Downloader, but it kind of uses like letters in the middle of the words and all that kind of thing.
I see. D for downloader, U for uploader, dude, or... Okay, I got it. That makes sense.
Yeah, so that's actually what the Arduino IDE, the actual code editor, is using under the surface to upload the compiled code that you've written to the Arduino. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to write a Node.js version of that so that we have like a really popular robotic scene in like the Node.js ecosystem called NodeBots. And we teach people how to use JavaScript to control electronics and robotics. And part of that involves running workshops. We have like an international NodeBots Day every year, which is really, really awesome. And we found that people had to download the, Arduino IDE, but after they kind of uploaded this one script that we gave them, they pretty much wrote JavaScript for the rest of the day. And so it was a really odd experience. And I wanted to write a whole bunch of JavaScript toolchains so that people running the workshop could also write their setup scripts in JavaScript too. And so it kind of all kept it all in the same ecosystem, and it allowed people to kind of write extensions very easily. So mm-hmm. that was a long-winded way of kind of explaining what AVR Girl Arduino does. It allows you to flash compiled C++ code onto devices using Node.js.
Ah, okay. So let me see if I can provide historical context and paraphrase that correctly then. So AVR Dude, the AVR is the Atmel microcontrollers, right? The Atmel AVR, that's the chip that powers the Arduino?
Yeah, correct. I did miss that bit out, so thank you. Yes.
Okay. And then AVR Dude is like 15 years old, like 14-year-old software that really hasn't even been thought about in the last 7 years or so. And it was very low level. And since Node is so much higher level, now AVR Girl gives you that kind of modern 2017 way of flashing this microcontroller, which just makes life better for everybody.
That's totally the idea. And what, in a mysterious turn of events, Arduino actually consume and use that library now. They have a code editor in the browser, and on Chrome OS, they ended up creating like an app that uses AVR Girl Arduino in a browser environment. So you can write code, but then flash that code to the device straight from the Chrome OS, which is kind of awesome. And so that was really exciting when they reached out to say, hey, thanks for writing this. We ended up like consuming and using it. So I thought that was really exciting.
That's cool. And it looks like it's an MIT license, so it's very friendly to things like that.
I try.
Yeah, nice. Yep. So let me understand then. I have opened up the Arduino IDE, and I know how to use that. When I'm writing Node.js code, does this mean I don't need the Arduino IDE at all? I just use AVR Girl instead?
It depends. So there are definitely there's definitely steps that you need to do before you use AVR Girl Arduino, where you can pretty much like write Arduino code in any editor, and you can use the Arduino IDE to just kind of compile that code and then upload it. But there are other tools out there that you can use to compile the Arduino code first. So there is that extra step beforehand that you need to do before you can actually take that finished file and upload it using AVR Girl. I do have an experimental library called AVR Pizza, which is a long story. And it actually doesn't require any like compilation toolchains to exist on your computer. What you can do is you can just send it. It's just a Node.js wrapper. So you give the path to the file that you want to compile, and it will kind of tarball that up, send it up to a cloud hosted compiler machine, and it will compile it and send it back down to you via an API request. So I called it AVR Pizza because it delivers, you supply a tuple and you get pizza, which is your compiled code. That was the idea.
That's cool. But that means that I could potentially teach Arduino to a whole room full of people, no matter what kind of machines that they had, and even if they had Chromebooks, like you said, right? And then it would be available to everyone.
That's exactly right. I think a lot of the time that we lose running these workshops is just the really nuanced differences between everyone's computers, even if they're even running a very similar operating system. And so this poor person would just get lost. They would be blaming themselves. When they finally asked for help, they were like 10 steps behind. And then we would feel that that was a bad experience for them and that we could do better than that. And so a lot of these tools have come about, and some of them are still experimental, like AVR Pizza, where I just want robotics to be the nicest, most fun experience out of the gate, so that intimidation factor that people kind of feel about hardware just completely flies out the window within like 10 seconds of the workshop.
Okay. Yeah, that's the kind of stuff where I work on .NET, where I want like telling people like, hey, everyone, let's start our workshop. But first we have to download a 2 gig like IDE and ISO file. And you don't want your workshop to be all about setup.
Right. And even if you set them that as homework, you know that like 50% or more of them are not going to get that email, or they're going to forget. And then they're going to turn up and you've got really bad Wi-Fi at the venue. And then everyone's trying to suck down 2 gigs and passing around a thumb drive with the software on it. So yeah, I totally get it.
So speaking of hardware and setup, if someone who is listening is finally, after listening to us for 25 minutes, decided that they're going to start streaming online, what do they need? Do they need to buy something, or could they stream to Twitch like right away?
That's a really great question. So all of the tools that I use, and including Twitch, the servers itself, I've never actually paid for. So it is really, really quick to get up and running, and it's free as well. And so Twitch, the platform, you sign up for a free account and you get what's called a streaming key. And that streaming key allows you to, once you've installed some streaming software, so for example, I use OBS, which is Open Broadcaster Software, and that's free and open sourced, obviously from the name Open. And so if you just drop your Twitch stream key in there, and you set up a scene with your webcam and maybe like a desktop capture, like that is actually the bare bones setup to get you going to start streaming out of the box.
Do you need a fast machine? Like, because you are basically, what, encoding the screen and sending it out the wire at X frames a second?
Yeah, totally. So I know that some people's laptops that are, you know, 4 or 5 years old can struggle a little bit. I did start streaming initially on a 2012 MacBook Pro, and that was a year ago. And so I did have to put a slight delay on my microphone, because it couldn't keep up with compositing all of the video. So I eventually upgraded to a better laptop, but that actually served me really well for, I think, at least 6 months. It was only when I added a second webcam and I was using that to kind of show the hardware project that I was working on my desk. That's when we just had a lot of dropped frames and things like that. So I would say that if you've got something like a MacBook Pro or, you know, a PC that's only like, you know, 3 years old, then you're probably good to go with that. And you can do nice tricks like altering the bitrate, maybe just lowering the quality slightly on the video, and you'll find that your machine can catch up a little bit more.
Okay. So giving, like, you don't just assume that everyone's running 1080p and small fonts. I assume that small fonts get kind of JPEG'd or artifacted, and you'd have to think a little bit about your presentation.
Yeah, definitely. So, just when I give presentations, you know, normal presentations on stage, I guess, I usually blow up my font really large. And so a lot of those rules still apply. Like, imagine you're presenting this to people that might be watching on their iPad, or they could be watching on a small computer, or you could just be going through a bit of a JPEG-y, artifact-y kind of looking stream if your internet's not great. So yeah, definitely compensate for that. But I've had pretty good mileage. It's usually the audio delays that sometimes happen to me.
A couple times I've tried live streaming and I've accidentally like pasted my password in, or someone has like seen a connection string. How do you prevent that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So a lot of people are really scared to start streaming. And I've like, in the last few days since writing the article, people have been like, I'm just so scared I'm going to accidentally open a dot file or something. And that's definitely something that I'm very, very careful with. I have a special scene that I set up, and scenes in OBS are like a thing where you can switch between different layouts. So I have a whole layout where it just shows my webcam in the corner, but I have this funny GIF, and I forget the artist's name, but it's really cool. And there's just a cartoon picture of a woman walking down the stairs, and it just says in the corner, doing secret stuff, give me a sec. And so if let's say I'm working with an API and my token expires, or I need to read some debug output, some people have a second monitor that they can kind of drag the window over to. But I work with just one monitor so I can stay focused on everything. And I end up switching to that scene, and people think it's really funny, and they're trying to guess what I'm doing. Sometimes they're like, oh, she's doing secret stuff. What's she doing? So it can actually add a little bit of like entertainment, whereas normally that sounds really boring. It's like, oh, wait, hang on. I have to like do the silly token thing. So yeah, there's definitely tactics.
But you do think about it like, Like you're a director of your own TV show. So you've got your like technical difficulties screen that pops up and you switch your scenes. So you're managing the camera angles and all that kind of stuff with these OBS scenes.
Yeah, it's so true. Like sometimes I'm super kooky and I'll switch to a completely different computer just by switching scenes. So I'll be like, oh, I'm now VNC'd into my Windows box so we can test out this bug that's only happening on Windows. Or, oh, this is my Linux laptop because like someone said that there was some funny behavior going on in Linux. So it's pretty funny.
My last question is that when you started this, you were actually rehearsing. Like you would prepare for your stream like it was a talk. But you don't even rehearse anymore, right? I mean, do you just show up and start typing?
Yeah, that's true. So I would say that the rehearsing came from me seeing it like I was coming from doing like a public speaking presentation, right? And so I thought, oh, well, like to give a good presentation, you have to rehearse lots of times. And I've never done live coding on stage, but I imagine that I would end up rehearsing that over and over again to get it right. And so I just thought, oh, that's what you do on Twitch. And also I was so afraid of tarnishing my reputation by making a single mistake.
Yeah.
But I also thought that, oh, if I make a mistake and start debugging, maybe people will get lost and not know what I'm doing, or maybe it will just ruin the kind of tutorial where people just kind of lose interest. So I was so afraid of my own reputation and just like showing those warts that I just rehearsed so many times, and I had a secret Git branch where I'd committed it, you know, in case I needed to quickly look at it in the morning. And it definitely was a symptom of my own self-esteem as a coder that I felt I hadn't really noticed that much. And so it was a really good thing to kind of allow me to get over that fear for sure. And I think that it makes you way more relatable, where people like, oh, people who even have been doing front-end coding for a long time still mess up. Or sometimes, you know, like they do typos, and it's important to show that, I think.
Yeah. It's like those pulpy newspapers that you see where it's like stars, they're just like us. I think everyone feels like they don't know what they're doing. And the fact is we're all learning. We're all on Stack Overflow. I mean, do you Google and go to Stack Overflow during your stream?
Totally. Yes. And sometimes I'll even say, can someone look this up for me?
Oh,
like I'll look up the bare method.
More awesome.
Yeah, and it's really cool. Or maybe I'll just look something up real quick and like I'll feel bad for, you know, like wasting time or what I think is wasting time. So I'll run back, I'll start using a method, and someone will say, actually, no, I think that this array method is better. And I just looked up what version of Node it's compatible with, and you're totally cool to use it. And so that's huge for me. And so I like to describe my Twitch stream as like massively multiplayer online pair programming, or like, you know, mob programming on the internet, because that to me shows that people feel comfortable to engage with me. They feel confident enough that even if they don't know much about the library I'm working on, that they feel that they're welcome to still help out. And I think that that has been the magic that I've seen in my community.
That's awesome. Well, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, this was super great.
Yeah, I'm going to put a link to your Medium post about lessons from my first year of live coding, as well as a link to your Twitch on the show notes. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.